Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby. My very special guest today is Nick Price. Nick is the CEO of Bright Purple Resourcing, which he co-founded in 1995. They're headquartered in Edinburgh. They've got 25 staff who specialize in placing technology change and transformation professionals. Nick is one of those people that knows absolutely everyone, and that's because he really is someone who gets involved in business and community life in Scotland, including industry associations, entrepreneurial groups, charities. I've seen him sleeping rough in the dead of winter to raise money for Social Bite and their campaign to end homelessness in Scotland. He's been a mentor for the Royal Bank of Scotland's Startup Accelerator. He's been a director at the Scottish Chamber of Commerce. I have known Nick for more than 25 years. He was one of my very first clients when I set up my training and consulting business in 2001. I've come to consider him a friend. Now, this episode is a little different from what I normally do because at Nick's insistence, instead of celebrating achievement today, we are going to celebrate failure, okay? And heads up, this episode has a parental advisory sticker. It probably will contain swearing, knowing Nick. So if that offends you, you might want to skip this episode. I don't imagine many recruiters will be upset, but just in case you're listening to this podcast with your kids playing in the background, you have been warned. Nick, thank you for being here.
Hey, you're welcome, Mark.
All right. Nick, can you, when I first asked you to do this, you were quite reluctant. Can you explain why you didn't want to come on the podcast and then what changed your mind?
Well, I think it was probably the fact that I listened to all the Resilient Recruiter podcasts, and I love them actually, but I felt that being, let's just put it as a small-time recruiter in the Principality of Scotland, that I was listening to some incredible people telling every single thing you need to know about recruitment, basically. And I didn't feel like I had anything to add. So when you asked me the first time, I was reticent because basically I didn't feel like I had anything to add.
So, which is nonsense, of course, because you wouldn't still be in business after 25 years if you weren't doing a lot of things right. But I like your take on this, and you actually proposed this to me. You said, look, I'll do it, but only if we can talk about failures and make that the emphasis instead of successes, because that will be something I think I can contribute to. So listen, with that spirit, I appreciate you coming on the show, Nick. Talk to us about your recruitment journey. You've had your business for 25 years. There have been some incredible highs and some real challenges. Can you talk to us about, like, what do you think has been the biggest challenge that you've dealt with as a CEO?
Well, actually, the biggest challenge I dealt with as CEO was actually becoming CEO. That was probably the biggest challenge I ever dealt with, because that was a period of my recruiting life where the trust between founding business partners completely shattered, and I had to release my business partner from his post from the company and then pick up the shattered pieces and go again. So I became CEO. Even though I founded the company, I wasn't CEO. I became CEO after a particularly difficult period for the company.
Can you say more about that? I think this is relevant to anybody who's in a partnership or, is one of many directors in an enterprise. What happened?
I started, you asked about my recruitment career, I fell into my recruitment job like almost every person I've ever met. I haven't met many people, including you, who planned to become recruiters.
I didn't even know this existed as a job.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a shame because it's an amazing career and it's an amazing industry. And, I remember joining the industry in 1989 when I had a full set of hair. And I remember people telling me the industry was finished back in 89. And reading articles thinking, oh my God, I've joined the wrong industry, even in my, in my midlife, I joined the wrong industry. But I started, you know, basically as a recruiter. That's what I started as, and I worked my way up. But eventually, when we founded Bright Purple in 1995, I went into business with a best friend, basically. And the other great magical idea that we had was 50-50. We should be equal partners. That's absolutely fine until it all falls apart. And then once it falls apart, 50-50 is a crap idea. And actually going into business with your best friend is a crap idea as well. Because eventually when you then have to sack your best friend, everything that you ever imagined to be painful comes to bear, basically. So we had been through some brilliant growth times, and had a great business. We never planned to have be giants. We were slightly older when we came into that sector, and so we never planned to be giants. We were having a great time. We had great relationships with customers, with our staff, etc. And then along came a downturn, and it hit us really, really hard. And in fact, almost wiped the legs from underneath us. We had mechanisms in place to get through it. But at the time, our CEO, my founding partner, was very blinkered about the future of recruitment. Older than I was, and had a blinkered vision of what was to come, and we couldn't shift it. So eventually I took a year out of the business, and I left the business for a year, and I went off and invested in some other ideas, and I took some time out, and then I came back a year later, and the recession was starting to bottom out. So we were seeing growth.
Nick, sorry to interrupt the flow. Which downturn are you referring to here?
Well, at the end of 2000 and 2000. I suppose it was a mix of the 2000 .com bubble burst.
Yes.
Y2K and everybody spending their money there. The euro arriving. All these huge projects, and then
9/11.
There was a whole raft of things that came together. And basically what happened was we got hit late in that. And as I say, we had plans to get through it. But what was apparent was that when you step away from the business, you expect obviously everybody else to step up. And there was friction when I came back, and that friction got worse, and that friction started to spread through the organization like wildfire, to be honest. And once that friction came between two 50-50 shareholding partners, there was only one thing that was going to happen, and that was one of us was going. And that's how it came to pass. So the sad part about that was I had spent a long number of years working with my business partner prior to starting the company. Best friends, godparents to each other's children, just chaos, to be honest.
And is that still finished, or have you been able to, rebuild anything there?
That's an interesting point, actually, because what happened was, I never saw him again until maybe a couple of years ago, and this is many years after the situation that happened. But I've always had a view that life's too short. I'm getting older, and certainly grudges and things like that. Maybe in my younger days, maybe I was a guy that would, I would not have found that easy to get over. But actually, I shook his hand recently. Well, in the last couple of years, we've bumped into each other. Would I go around to dinner at his house? Probably not.
Fair enough. So it sounds like that was a very stressful process, Nick. Looking back on it with the benefit of hindsight, what would you have done different?
Of course it was stressful. I mean, I think that it's interesting, actually. I talked to a lot of my peers, and you said at the start there that this is something that others will relate to. Absolutely, it's something you'll relate to, because too many people hide this stuff in closets. They carry on, and they try to find a way through it, when actually, you know, make the decisions quick. We talk about fail fast, and I guess we might talk about that a little bit later on. But actually, there's no... You know, from a point of view of what would I have learned from it, I don't think the writing was always on the wall, because when you go into a partnership, you tend to go into a partnership with rose-tinted glasses.
You're optimistic. Just like, you know, when you get married, you're going into it assuming that this is, you know, this is going to work out.
Yeah, that's probably what my first wife said. you go into it with rose-tinted glasses. You always see the best, because in the case of myself and my business partner, we were a very successful recruiting team for a very big firm, and we were very good at what we did. And of course, when you leave and set up, and then you're very good again together, that's fine. Until then, you start having structures and titles. And I've heard the word on some of your podcast, egos, mentioned. Somebody who thinks that being right all the time is important, rather than actually admitting when you're wrong. Yeah. So what would I have done differently? It was too late to do anything differently. It was set from the minute we joined together, because the underlying things that you don't see about people come to the surface when the most amount of stress hits. And I think that right now, if you look at where we are as a world just now, you know, we're deep in the midst of a pandemic that is, you know, wiping out people, sadly. You know, businesses is important, but actually the sad part just now is people are getting wiped out left, right, and center. And the stress levels on leaders is immense. And I would imagine right now there are quite a few companies around the world that are actually starting to see what their business partners are like, you know, what the support behind them is, the care for their well-being, never mind the well-being of all the people that they have the responsibility to look after. But actually, a leadership team needs to be cared for as well.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely. Nick, we've talked before about, you know, highs and lows. When you guys were sort of at your biggest, what sort of size was Bright Purple?
About 40 million turnover.
40 million pounds, yeah.
Yeah, 40 million pounds, yes.
Yeah.
Well, profitable enough for me to have a, you know, comfortable life.
Great. And then... how many people is that? Does that represent in the
at that team? Time? We were probably about 50 people.
About 50. Okay, so you're about half the size now.
People wise, yeah. But actually, I think it's interesting that we never set out to be a big company. You know, we never set out to be a giant that dominated. You know, I think that. You know, it's interesting, you and I have known each other for an awful long time. And you're right, we've known each other before I started my company. And, you know, I've always had huge respect for you. But one of the biggest pieces of respect I have for you is that it's about you and the quality of what you deliver. And if there were 50 of you, would it be the same service? I'm not sure. And I think that was the view we took on our company. We wanted it to be... We knew that there would be bigger challenges to grow in a huge organization. So we are very comfortable where we are. I've no plans to have some enormous organization. You know, I presume that when somebody eventually takes us over, they'll be buying somebody small, agile, and efficient. They won't be buying a giant.
Interesting. So can you say a little more about that? Like what are the benefits of keeping it smaller rather than, you know, grow?
I guess that we can focus now more on, so the pandemic actually has what the pandemic has done is it's given us time, almost 4 months now, to sit back and reflect on what we want to be coming out the other side of it. So rather than think about, you know, if I think about, I don't know, a couple of years ago, we had a leadership team that were looking to add lots of things to lots of offerings to the organization. They were looking to, you know, how can we have people here, people there, etc. I went along with it, but you know, was I totally 100% bought into it? You know, I'm going to say, you know, that was a mistake from my side, because I probably paid lip service to it, and I probably went along with it rather than actually making the call. So the benefit just now is that the pandemic has given us time to sit back, reflect, and to reflect properly on what the next 10 years might look like in a new norm, because we also have to remember that, you know, where we came from before March isn't going to be the same for the foreseeable future and might never be the same again. So small, agile, fleet of foot, efficient, able to absolutely focus in on the people that work for us and make them the very best that we can make them. You know, will they be considered to be the best in the industry? We think they're the best in the industry. Yeah. How can we make them better? Well, that's the point. We've been reflecting, you know, training. We have to get better at it. You talk about resilient recruiter. You know, I would say that since I've been in the industry since late 89, I'm a resilient recruiter. You know, I've been through so many recessions, battles, wars, mistakes, errors, that, you know, I feel like I'm resilient. Yeah. And I want my people to be resilient, because I owe it to them to give them a long-term career, like I've had a long-term career. Whether that long-term career is with Bright Purple or whether they decide to go somewhere else and work for somebody else, etc. You know, I'm not going to worry about that, because a long time ago I left somebody else. So I'm not going to worry about that, but I want to see my new young leadership team given every chance to invest in people and to make us the best that we can be.
Awesome. I think we're on a roll here, Nick. So this is great. You know, what are some of the other, so you're often in a mentoring role at this stage in your career. So if you're mentoring sort of young, hungry, you know, recruitment business owners who are coming up, what are some of the other mistakes that you've made that you would like to point out to them to try and, I mean, they're probably going to make them anyway, because that's life, right? But if you could help them to avoid some of those pitfalls, what would be the big pitfalls?
How long is the podcast? Is it about an hour, isn't it?
Yeah.
I probably need half a day to round them all off. You're right. I mean, I am a mentor. I heard you mentioning I've mentored for the Royal Bank's startup community. I have. And I've mentored in, you know, I'm mentoring some small startup technology businesses just now. I suppose the important thing is that they make the mistakes. You know, one of the things that, you know, I'm a firm believer is if we don't try and, you know, and take those risks, we'll never know. Now, to be fair, there are some people out there who have taken risks and have been there at the right time, got something right, and absolutely nailed it. Yeah. And I've had some of those experiences, but I think that, you know, for me, the real learning lessons have been around people.
It's a people business. So it's that's a huge,
I don't believe there'll be a recruitment owner, leader, manager out there who hasn't named that as their number one challenge, getting it right. Because you go along with the kind of assumption that you're the perfect person to pick the right people for your organization. And actually, that's often a big mistake. I mean, over many years, I thought I knew people. I thought I knew how to pick the people that were going to move my organization to the next level. And sometimes when I, you know, I would rubber stamp people who I said they're absolutely going to turn us into world beaters, and I was wrong. You know, often they turned out to be a bigger challenge for us than the challenge we faced when we didn't have them. So managing disruptive people, managing egos, managing people who don't care about the person that sits next to them, managing people who don't care about the brand that they work for, you know, and don't believe in that brand. They just want money. Yeah. Those kinds of people, I have made multiple errors. Yeah. I could write a book on that piece alone. Yeah. And so for the people who are out there in the early stages of their company, I think it's about realizing that, you know, it's not all about you. It's not all about you as, you know, the leader of an organization, the founder of a startup, etc. It's about all those people who are behind you, actually often doing all the heavy carrying. Yeah. And those people that do the heavy carrying are often the best judge of the people who should be sitting in the seat beside them. Yet, you know, we see it in every single organization. I talk to, you know, my chairman owns, other recruiting companies. And when we have a chat, you'll ask, you know, what's been, you know, how's it been? And almost all the time it's, yeah, well, we shouldn't have hired him, or we shouldn't have hired her, or, it doesn't matter. You'll never get it right. You know, my chairman made significant wins with huge organizations. And as I say, today runs some very, very big, much bigger organizations than us. And one of his biggest talking points at our board meeting is how the others got it wrong with their people as well. So I never feel bad. I never feel bad about getting it wrong. You just got to end it as quickly as you can. And that doesn't always happen, by the way.
Okay, so there's a couple of points to pick up on there, but starting with that one, like, what are the signs? How long do you give someone, and what are the signs that, uh-oh, this was a mistake?
You know, I said, that's an interesting one, because I was listening to one of the previous podcasts, and it was the gentleman from Singapore.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was a fascinating podcast, fascinating interview.
That was Richard Hoon.
Richard Hoon. Well, I've listened to that one actually a couple of times, because I really like that, particularly like that one. But actually, in that interview, he talked about bringing back the professionalism to our industry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you at one point had said in that interview that you'd been given 3 months. You were talking about a lack of training, and you had been given 3 months, etc. So to answer your question, how long do you give somebody? If within the first week they aren't the same person that you interviewed, then get them gone. Yeah.
Right.
And that's not a bad, that's not because you are trying to be, you know, a nasty employer or something like that. But often when you keep people in a seat for a job that they're not capable of doing, even with training, you're causing them more harm than you're causing them good. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I've got people that have worked for me, loyally worked with me for a number of years. Some of them are part of my board now. And they came to us as juniors and are now part of the board. So I'm all for giving the people that are helping us to grow or helping us as a business the opportunity. But I think that people come into our industry thinking that it's an easy way to make money, maybe they think it's an easy way to have a career. Maybe they think it's just, maybe they just think it's a way to get a job, just to do something. And I don't think enough people realize just how great a career this is if you absolutely fully commit to it. And so I think that what you end up finding is that you do more damage to people if you keep them in a seat longer than is necessary. We're at the end of the day, we are a sales organization. We are selling solutions that are revolve around people. We're putting people into our customers. It's a sales job, and people think that it's a HR job, or they think it's a consultancy job. You know, we hear the word consultant, and they've got 1 year's experience, and you think, wow, you know, I had 20 odd years of industry before I came into recruitment. You know, maybe I could be called a consultant. So when you've got somebody who interviews with you and tells you how amazing they are and what they're going to do for you and how committed they are, and then the first week in, they're a different person to what you interviewed, then at the end of that first week, you should have a very nice chat with them and explain that potentially recruitment isn't for them. Yeah. So there is no set time. You know, what you said it yourself, you were sat down and you were given 3 months. The pressure of being given 3 months is not good for your health. We don't give anybody 3 months. You know, if we give people the opportunity to be the best that they can be, and if that fits into what we consider to be the best, then they stay and they have a great life with us. But we, you know, but equally, yeah, we've had somebody that I think just last year or the year before lasted 2 weeks because they were not the person that interviewed.
Interesting. No, that's a good benchmark. So how have you, I know you said, look, you're going to still make mistakes and because it's not an exact science, but how have you adapted your hiring process to try and improve your success rate?
Yeah, well, I think that when you say adapted, I think it's, we are not a large organization, okay? So we are not we are not Hays or, you know, one of these giants who probably have, you know, 50 HR people, well, maybe not now, but who maybe have a huge number of HR people inside their organization coming up with all these, amazing strategies around recruiting and onboarding and everything else. You know, we're a small company, 25 people. A lot of what we do goes on gut feel. Yeah. It's gut feel that has got us to 25 years. There is no battle plan about how we hire. There is no set format. You know, we're working remote just now and have been since March. We're two final interviews for two people to join us. Because we have two people that have come available that fit a particular need just now. How do we work that? Well, we're doing it from home. We're doing it between multiple people, trying to do it on Zoom. There is no set format. We still rely on our gut. Now, are we right to do that? Maybe not. But again, I come back to it. It's got us to 25 years. We've got, you know, some really super people. And I think we will never change. I just quite simply, so that might sound like, the height of stupidity to some of these giants that I've listened to out there. But actually it works for us. And I think what's really important is what works for you, works for you. What works for me, works for me. I'm not going to complain about works. I'm not going to judge on what works for you. Don't judge me.
Okay. Fair enough, Nick. Nick, can you tell the story of you turned down a big offer for the business and what happened after that?
Yeah. So I suppose every recruiter is always in the market to be sold. And over the 25 years, we've had various organizations, you know, when we were fast growing in the early stages and onwards, we've had offers for the business. One particular offer was very attractive. The organization were huge. They had lots of money, lots of cash to burn, and they wanted an operation in Scotland. We were making a lot of news at that time, and we were approached by their executive who flew up from London. I think I might have even had a tie on that day, they certainly had their ties on, that's for sure. And they came and talked to us, and it was all very amicable, and they were very attractive. They seemed to be the kinds of people that we could work with. So the exec had a chat, and we decided to go down to London and meet them. And we went down to London, met with their FD and some of their other execs. And the outcome of that was we listened to this amazing story about where we might go. And I started getting pictures in my head of lying on a beach a little bit earlier than I planned to. But when we went away, we suddenly started to think, and by the way, the offer was mainly paper. So the offer was mainly shares. Yeah. And when we came back to Scotland, we started to think, actually, why do we need them? We've got a perfectly good business. We have great relationships with customers that we've had for a long time. We've got great people. Right now, what would we do? I mean, if I had sold at that point, you know, I had left an organization to work for myself, and then I was going to go back and work for somebody else again. And the other thing was, I'd left an organization that was controlled out of London, and I worked for them in Scotland, and Yair was going to do exactly the same thing, work for an organization out of London running an office in Scotland. So we decided that even though it was an awful lot of money, we decided to turn it down, and they were gobsmacked. It was actually quite funny because it was before the time of, well, it was certainly before Zoom and Skype and everything else. So it was a case of meeting in London, shaking their hands and saying no thanks, which, you know, still makes me smile today because, you know, they were definitely dumbfounded, that's for sure. But what was even more, I'm not going to say, what was even more right about that decision was 6 months later, their shares crashed through the floor, absolutely bottomed. Yeah. And we would have been working for nothing because all of the paper that we had would have been worth absolutely zero. So anybody that came after that, the minute they used the word paper, we just said, no, thank you. And that's, you know, that's what happened. That organization never recovered, by the way. And so we would have given up all the hard work that we put in and seen nothing for it. So a piece of advice to all of you out there who think, you know, selling your company is the right thing to do. You know, it's your company. You've put all the blood, sweat and tears into it. Somebody with deep pockets just wants, they just want it, they, you know, and they'll do anything to get it. That doesn't mean that they're the right fit for you. That doesn't mean that, you know, you're part of the family. You know, when, you know, you might become the estranged, you know, the estranged niece or something at the end of it and, you know, find yourself, find yourself not at the dinner table, but, you know, sitting in the outhouse or sitting in the garden shed having your dinner. Because you definitely won't be at the top table, that's for sure.
Wow, so that turned out to be a great decision in retrospect. You must have...
Mark, one of my very few ones, considering this discussion was all supposed to be about getting things wrong, that was one of my getting things right.
Excellent. Nick, can you talk about fuck-up nights and how you got involved in that? Because that's how we most recently have become reacquainted.
Yeah. Not only most recently, but last night you were an amazing speaker, sharing honestly, rawly and openly your own challenges, and for which I thank you, graciously thank you. A couple of years ago, I'm 59. You know, I'm not a young recruiter anymore. I'm 59. I still have all the spark and energy that I had when I started out in this industry. But what happens when you get older is you start to realize that all the successful people that tell you how successful they are and how they could afford their Ferraris and their Lamborghinis and their yachts, etc., they never really teach you anything. You go along, you feel, you know, you go along to a chat by some amazing guy or some amazing lady, you get super motivated, and you feel invigorated. And I've been on many of those over the years, but I've never really learned anything because their version of success or their view of success isn't the same as my view of success. It's not the same. You know, if for me, what's the most successful thing in my life? I'm 59 years old. I've got Bright Purple. I'm a founder of a technology business. I sit on the board of a charity. But the most successful thing I've ever done is three children who are amazing citizens. Yeah. I will never be more proud of anything than my children. So, you know, if I sell Bright Purple tomorrow for hundreds of millions, it still won't matter. So the problem with trying to view success is it means different things to everybody else. So how do you teach success? That's impossible. But one thing you can learn from is the commonality of failure. Yeah. So a couple of years ago, I was just sick. I had started to rescind lots of offers to go along to speak at events about my successes, I had started to almost go back into my shell regards events, and then I happened to stumble by pure chance. I was in London, and I stumbled upon an event called Fuck Up Nights, and I thought, wow, I have no idea what that is, but I'm going. It was the best event I ever attended. Yeah, I listened to three people tell their stories of failing, and what happened instantly was I found I was in an audience of people who were all there, who were all talking about the same thing: the mistakes and errors that they'd made, the lessons they'd learned from it, the failings that they'd had personally and in business, and how those things had interacted with each other and had impacted decision making, had impacted family lives, etc. And everybody I talked to, I could relate to. In fact, that first meeting, I must have made 20 contacts I'm still very good friends with today, 2 years later. I don't think I've ever been to an event where I've felt a bond with people. I've never been to, you know, some big show and came away thinking, oh my God, you know, I've got a new family friend. But I came away from that feeling like I'd found a tribe, and, you know, a tribe that I actually belong to. Because I had personally failed so many times, everything they were talking about, I could relate to. So I came back to Scotland. I did a little bit of investigating, and I found out that it was actually a serious organization based out of Mexico City, founded 6 or 7 years ago. And today, in over 320 cities, in over 91 countries around the world. And so I took the licenses for Edinburgh and Glasgow. And for the last 2 years, almost 2 years, we've been running the events.
Awesome. I mean, look, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in the one that we had yesterday. It was quite an experience. And I've given hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of talks. I don't know how many thousands of people I've spoken to, but I was more nervous for that talk than virtually any other that I can think of, because it's not easy, is it, to talk about the things that you got wrong or the mistakes you've made. It's painful. And yet, what I found was that I could relate to listening to the other speakers. I could really empathize with, you know, even though their stories were different to mine, then I think I could relate to them on a human level. So it was powerful. And so well done to you for discovering that and bringing it to Scotland. And your daughter, Siri, did an amazing job. And she's only, I think, 20 or something. She did an amazing job of orchestrating the whole thing.
Yeah. So. And I think, you know, what does it allow? It's cathartic. It allows you to open up not with the fear that people are there to judge you, that people are there to listen and learn to you, because they listen and learn from you, because they all have been in your position? Different businesses, maybe different times in their lives, etc. But actually, they've all been in your position. And if you look at the three speakers last night, you all told incredible stories of getting it wrong. All were different, but the theme was the same: getting it wrong. And we had a global audience on there last night, and you saw the chat box lighting up with, I can totally relate to that. I can totally relate to that, because it doesn't matter whether you're in Southern Carolina, South Carolina, Lithuania, India, Africa, as it was last night, Germany, France, Scotland. It doesn't matter. The mistake you make in South Carolina is the same mistake you make in Edinburgh. The ability to relate, but the most important part is that tribe shares that burden, yeah, of failure. So you feel cathartic because you feel like, oh my God, I've said it and it's out there and nobody judged me for it.
Awesome. Nick, I mean, I feel like there's lots more stories to tell, but we might need to say, let's do it again. It's been awesome catching up with you, my friend. Thank you for finally agreeing to do this.
Very welcome. It's been a cathartic pleasure.
So, Nick, I'll put all your contact info and website links and so on in the show notes at recruitmentcoach.com/podcast. But if people want to reach out to you to connect, share ideas, find out more about Prime or whatever, what's the number one place they should do that?
Use the Bright Purple email address, nick.price@brightpurple.co.uk.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks again, sir. It was awesome speaking to you as usual, and I'll look forward to catching up soon.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. Cheers, my friend.
Thank you.
Bye.